This is John McMurray of the Society for American Baseball Research, and I'm pleased to be speaking this morning with Pete O'Brien. Pete played 12 seasons in the major leagues with the Texas Rangers, the Cleveland Indians, and the Seattle Mariners. We are recording this interview with Pete's permission on November the 30th, 2023. And Pete, what got you interested in baseball?
Well, I think for the most part, you know, baseball was huge in America back then. And so a lot of the kids were playing it. I grew up in Santa Monica, California, which was a, you know, great area to play baseball. And we played all the sports pretty much throughout the year. But baseball, you know, I took to it, loved it. I had a neighbor's uncle, Danny Petta, who kind of took me under his wing. And when I was like 7 or 8, he hung a tire in my backyard. He, you know, got me climbing the rope and really took an interest in my game. And Danny went on to coach in the junior colleges in Southern California. Great baseball guy, absolutely passionate beyond. And I think I caught a lot of that. And yeah, just, you know, I was good at it early. And so it was fun to play. And I would just say having 4 older brothers and watching them operate in Little League and doing that thing, it was just kind of a natural progression for me.
Being in California, what was your favorite team growing up?
The Los Angeles Dodgers had their pictures all over my bedroom. In fact, Wes Parker was, you know, probably my favorite Dodger at the time. So I don't know. That was kind of foreshadowing, I guess. I just love the Dodgers, you know, and I follow the Angels. I love Nolan Ryan. I love Frankie Tanana when he was there. So, you know, we had great baseball teams. Both the Angels and the Dodgers were great, to watch. And the Dodgers were probably a little more, you know, well-known and followed in Southern Cal. So, yeah, I went to a lot of games and just enjoyed the game, enjoyed watching it. I consumed it daily. And so I must have a, you know, a real spirit for the game, evidently.
At what point did playing first base get your attention?
That's a good question. I played a little outfield, a little first base, pitched a little bit in Little League. And then when we moved up to Carmel my freshman year, and I was actually walking to the golf meeting. Figured we were in Monterey Peninsula, why not golf? And a couple of guys that I had just met said, you can play golf all your life. We're going to the baseball meeting. And I said, yeah, that's a good point. So I went, and I actually was pitching in high school for most of the time. And then I hurt my arm my junior year. And couldn't pitch, so I just said, well, I'm going to go over to first base because I'm pretty sure I can still hit. And kind of took off from there, played first base at Carmel my senior year, and then went to Monterey Peninsula Junior College before I heading out to Nebraska.
Now, you graduated from Carmel High School in 1976. You weren't drafted, and you weren't offered a scholarship out of high school, rather. Was this something that you were expecting to receive?
You know, not really, John. I think, you know, I wasn't, I grew a lot my junior to senior year. I was pretty, you know, I was probably 5'5", 5'6", and then all of a sudden I was 6 foot going into my senior year. And, you know, I just, I didn't really expect it. I knew I was pretty good, but it didn't really disturb me too much. I knew I was kind of probably go to Monterey Peninsula Junior College just to get, you know, going at a local level and see how that all panned out.
What was it like playing baseball at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln?
One of my fondest memories. I mean, the fans there, unbelievable. The people there, kind as can be. And it was just, it was the right move for me. We came, I went down to Southern Cal to play in a summer league team. And John Sanders was leaving Arizona Western and heading back to Lincoln to kind of reignite the program. He was from Grand Island. And he took 8 of us off that summer team in LA. And we all went back to Lincoln had a little civil war going, you know, with the existing Cornhuskers. But we totally matched. He did a fabulous job of bringing that team together. And we went on to the regionals. And really, it was a perfect level for me. It was the Big Eight back then, you know, and a lot of guys from USC and UCLA that were kind of second tier on those teams, they were on that summer team and they decided to come back. So we had some pretty good talent going back there.
At what point did you think you might be able to play in the major leagues?
You know, I think having success, I think in Nebraska, you know, I had two good years there. And, you know, I just really wanted the shot. I didn't care where I got selected or whatever. I just really wanted to continue on in pro ball and just felt like, hey, once you're in, all it takes is hard work. You just hope you outwork your opponents and see where it takes you.
So after your junior season in 1979, you're selected in the 15th round of the amateur draft by the Texas Rangers. How did you feel about being picked by Texas at that time?
You know, I loved it. You know, didn't know much about them. So dug into their history a little bit, but Patty Cottrell signed me. He was the Northern Scout or the Northern California Scout for the Rangers. And I remember trying to negotiate with Patty, and Patty was 75 at the time and just through and through baseball. What a wonderful guy. And I said, hey, I got a year left in my you know, for eligibility for college, you know, I mean, can we get a little bit more out of this draft as far as money? And he said, hey, Pete, I've checked out your grades. I think you need to go ahead and sign. But they weren't too bad, but he was right. And, you know, wouldn't get a probably get much better for me, even if I duplicated that year that I had as a junior. So it was the right thing to do. And, you know, marched on down to Sarasota to rookie ball and went through all the levels with the Rangers and finally called up in 82.
In September of 82, you were called up, make your major league debut. You go to a team, which was common at the time, which had a number of veteran players. How were you welcomed to the Texas Rangers when you first got up to the team?
Yeah, you know, was having a great year in Denver, and Dave Hosteller and I were alternating at first base throughout the first half of the year, and we were both having great years. And at that time in Arlington, that stadium was not a left-handed hitter's paradise at all. So at the halfway point, they called up Hosteller, and they sent down Randy Bass and Pat Putnam, two left-handed hitting first basemen. And Haas went up, and I think he hit three home runs in the first week. I was watching ESPN, and they were playing the Bonanza song, Haas, you know, for Haas. And I'm thinking, I might need a new position. So I went to Rich Donnelly at the All-Star break in AAA, and I said, hey, I want to play the second half of the season in left field because Hosteller looks like he's here to stay, and I need to get up there. And Billy Sample was there at the time, very good left fielder. And so I just thought, well, any position out in the outfield may work for me. So I played the rest of the year in the outfield. And I think it really helped my prospects for sure, letting them know that I could play more in first base. And so when I got up there, it was great. You know, got into games a lot, played a little left field, played a little first base. So that September went really well for me. I think they hit maybe four home runs and kind of really got my feet wet.
So you didn't play very much in 82, but in 83, you played 154 games under manager Doug Rader. What was the big difference in terms of you playing every day the next season?
Well, in 82, I was a September call-up. So, you know, you're only going to get that last month really to play. So 83 was really my rookie year. And Doug had just taken over the team, and he said, hey, you're going to be our first baseman. Hosteller's going to DH. You know, and I was ecstatic. I was probably a little better defensively than Haas, but I just thought, hey, this may work really well. And I think putting Haas at DH as a young hitter was, you know, real problematic. And I don't think that went over too well. Haas kind of struggled. I don't know what I could have done being a DH, you know, at 24, 25 and having to deal with that, you know, that in between two innings before your next at bat. So, you know, I was a little unfortunate, but yeah, once I got in there, Doug really hung with me and, you know, it wasn't the greatest rookie year, but it wasn't terrible, I guess. But yeah, got in a lot of games and, you know, good education that first year for sure.
You were known for your defense in particular. How did you become a good defensive first baseman? And did you model your play after any other contemporary first baseman?
Not too much contemporary. I just know Wes Parker had a bunch of gold gloves, and I thought that was pretty cool, and I'd love one of those. And just, you know, you're as a player, you're thinking, what's going to keep me on the field? I mean, you got it. You can't, you know, unless you're going to hit 40 or 50 a year, you're going to have to do something defensively. So I just really prided. I love playing defense, jumped a lot of rope, you know, wanted to be have quick feet, good hands. And I just took to the position. I, you know, really loved it. You're in all the plays. And so it was an easy position for me to learn and to work at just because I love the position.
For someone who hasn't seen you play, how would you describe your defensive style?
You know, I wouldn't say flashy. I would say, you know, just solid, you know, trying to catch everything at you. And really trying to put yourself in a position to make some good plays in the hole, you know, knowing the hitters and all of that. But, you know, just steady, you know, you got to learn how to pick balls. It builds the confidence of your infielders and, you know, just try to do all the little things really good. And, you know, like I said, whatever I could do to keep myself on the field and in the lineup, I was going to try to do.
Now in that 83 season, you had Bucky Dent at shortstop and Buddy Bell at third base. Tell us a little about each of those players.
Yeah, both great guys. Took great care of me, you know, didn't haze me too much. And, you know, just great to watch them go about their business day in and day out. Buddy was fabulous third baseman. Bucky, great shortstop. So it was nice to have that leadership on the infield with us. Just admired them both. Great in the clubhouse and great for a, you know, a young kid coming up to model.
It wasn't a given at that time that a young player would necessarily break into the starting lineup. What was it like being a young player on a team of so many veterans? You also had players like Larry Parrish, Jim Sundberg was there, Bill Stein was there, and you're a 24-year-old playing every day.
Yeah. In fact, my seat was right in between Charlie Huff and Larry Parrish, and I used to watch Charlie when he was with the Dodgers. he was with the Dodgers. So those two guys were very important. You know, as locker mates and to keep you kind of focused. And then your hitting coaches, you know, I had some great hitting coaches, Tom Robson, Merv Rettman, totally two different personalities. Merv was my rookie year hitting coach, and I absolutely adored him. Through my struggles, you know, I might be 0 for 30 and I'd go to Merv and go, dude, am I ever going to get a hit again? And Merv might say to me, you might be hot right now, Pete. You know, you might be hot and you might be 0 for 60 in the next month or so. So he kept things pretty light and kind of got my, you know, got me out of my own head and just a wonderful guy. And Tom Robson I had in the minor leagues and we worked a lot together and absolutely adored him. So I was pretty fortunate to have a lot of, you know, great hitting coaches that have been in the big leagues and then have the players that we had as veterans. I was very fortunate.
Those Texas teams early in your career struggled quite a bit. Doug Rader was fired in 1985. You got Bobby Valentine as a manager. Could you discuss a little about the difficulties of playing for a losing team early in your career?
Yeah, we didn't have much of a track record at that time. You're just trying to do the best you can to hope, you know, hope that helps the team get better. You know, and it just goes to show how, you know, how hard it is to win. I mean, it's just great, great players. We were the Senators before we were the Rangers. You know, and it goes down to draft picks and the talent that you're getting. And then what are you developing? So it was a rough road there. When Bobby got there, you know, we started really inserting a lot of youth. The kiddie corps came up with Guzman and Correa and Witt and Mitch Williams. So the arms started showing up, and that's when we got pretty competitive, because I think as an offense, we were pretty good. We were formidable for even the down years. But when we got some good young arms, we started taking off.
Now in 84, you hit 18 home runs, and then you hit more than 20 home runs in each of the next three seasons. What was the difference in your ability to hit home runs? You also, in 1986, had a .290 average, the best of your career, and so you were hitting for both average and for power. What made you develop as a hitter?
You know, I think just comfort at the level, and getting bigger and stronger each offseason. You know, I had to play in all the games to get my numbers. You know, Juan Gonzalez could play in 100 games and get my numbers. So I had to play in them all and wanted to play in them all. You know, it's just something, you know, I love to play baseball. I don't necessarily love to watch it. I did as a kid, but, you know, as you get older, you much rather play it. And I just think for the most part, you know, just getting comfortable up there and just putting in the work. I just felt like the off season was a huge part for me. Couldn't get hurt, had to get stronger. And so I just went to work in the off season and, you know, did the best I can to come in as big a shape. And we were just kind of getting in where players were starting to use the weight room a lot more. So that was just something you had to do at that time.
You had a smooth and what I would call natural swing. Was that something that was indeed natural, or was it something that you worked on?
Yeah, I probably worked on it too much, John. You know, you tend to get a little paralysis by analysis, but I did love my swing, and you know, I did some things that I wasn't aware I was doing that made me successful. And, you know, you get them pointed out every now and then, but, you know, just tipping the bat, you know, I used to just tip the bat, and that was never a thought when I was going bad. Well, you're not tipping the bat. So, you know, maybe I was a mental midget in some degree, but, you know, I love my swing actually. And I grew up, well, when I was in Monterey Peninsula, Albert Hood, who was a good friend, he was like 35 and he came back to play. He had eligibility left and he was a good player. But we would throw each other batting practice before practice just about every day. And he was a lefty. And so I really got to getting inside the ball. And I thought if I could hit the ball over the left field wall, right field should be no problem. So I really started just kind of becoming a gap-to-gap hitter. And I think that probably helped me stay in the big leagues, because I wasn't so, you know, even though on your first base, you got to hit home runs. I wasn't too much dwelling on it. I thought, hey, if I could hit 40 doubles or 30 doubles and drive in RBIs was my whole idea. You know, I just thought like, you know, if you're not driving in runs, what else are you doing? And so I thought my approach at the big league level of using both sides of the field kept me there for, you know, for the 12 years. I never got caught up in getting pull happy and thinking I had to hit home runs.
You mentioned that you were very happy with your swing. Were you receptive to hitting coaches or managers trying to tell you how to hit, or would you have preferred just to kind of go your own way?
It's a great question. I did tend to love to work alone. I love the batting tee. I love to figure it out for myself. And really Merv and Robbie, you know, they didn't hound you too much on, you know, technique or anything like that. Merv Rettman was, if you're taking the ball right, you're probably swinging right. You know, you're not out on your front foot. Robbie was more controlled, you know, relaxing on your backswing and getting after it on your foreswing. So they didn't touch on too much technicalities that could really kind of overwhelm you. And, but yeah, to answer your question, I did love to work alone. I probably would be at minor leagues from rookie ball on up. I would be out on the tee 90% of the time, maybe an hour before we started workouts, and just trying to just groove it. And I like to just process it my own way, I guess.
Now, that 1986 team finished 87-75, second place in the American League West. Of course, there were fewer spots in the postseason at that time. A successful season. What was the biggest change from 86 to relative to the years prior?
Yeah, I think the arms. I think we ended up getting Eddie Correa was fabulous till he got hurt. Jose Guzman, Mitchy Williams was terrific. You know, we had a nice young group of position players. Encavilla was come, it was there, and Ruben Sierra. So the talent level was really raised through the draft and through our scouts. So I just think we just, you know, we got a little more talent and we had a lot of, you know, youthful energy. Bobby Valentine was great manager for that type of team. You know, he brought in a lot of energy himself, great X's and O's guy, very passionate about the game. And I just think we collectively just came together and really, we had a blast that year and, you know, mixed in with Larry and Charlie. And I think Buddy was probably gone by then. I think we might've had Jeff Russell, you know, Bouchel was up. So Scotty Fletcher. So yeah, I just think the talent level went up and we competed real well.
And Charlie Huff won 17 games on that 1986 team. You mentioned how your locker was initially next to his. What was Charlie Huff like both as a person and as a pitcher?
Just top shelf. I mean, he loved the game. He'd talk the game a little bit. He'd have fun with the game. And, you know, super encouraging and just a steady force in that, you know, in that clubhouse. He great work ethic, went around his, you know, did his business and he was ready to go, you know, every time he pitched. And he was just a quality guy and very fortunate to have him and Larry the same way. Just, you know, they're just very calming for a young player. So I couldn't thank them more.
You mentioned about how you were interested in hitting doubles and hitting the ball to both sides of the field. What was it like playing in Arlington Stadium? Was that stadium one where you felt it maximized your talents?
Yeah, you know, they kept building on top of the fence, you know, the big scoreboard. And as that thing got taller, the better that park became for a left-handed hitter. So I was very fortunate. You know, when I first came up in 82, there was nothing past the pavilion in right field. And that wind would just smoke anything you hit out there. It had to be just fence high to maybe dodge that wind. So as they kept building and putting the advertising in the big screen, you know, big scoreboard and the screen, and that got taller, that became that was a wind tunnel. All of a sudden that wind was coming down and shooting back out. So it actually became a very, very nice hitter's park. Jim Anglia, the groundskeeper, and he kept that infield so fast. It was like a putting green on the grass and fast. So, you know, turned into a pretty good hitter's park for sure.
Wonder if you could comment on some of the other players you played with for a period of time in Texas. Pete Encavilla, Odubee McDowell, you mentioned Ruben Sierra a little earlier, and wondered if you could give some comments on each of those.
So Inky was my bat boy in Connie Mack. He was up in Monterey too. And Tony, his brother, was maybe a little older. Frankie, his middle brother, and I played together at Monterey Peninsula Junior College. So the Encavillas were big in Carmel, Monterey, and when I was up there, their dad was very pronounced in the amateur baseball in the area, and the Encavillas had a great baseball name, so that was fun, and we had some laughs about that, but Inky obviously went on to have an unbelievable college career, and the guy could just, you know, he could just mash a baseball. There is just no question. how good he was, and a great teammate. We had a lot of fun together. Odabe, you know, number one pick for us. He came up and really, you know, handled himself very well. I mean, that's a tough position to be in. You know, you're kind of the savior as the number one pick. But Odabe did a great job and was a, you know, fun player to watch. He had great strides in the outfield, nice arm, hit for power. So he was a great addition. And then Ruben, you know, was just unbelievable for his age. I think we got him when he was 19 or 20. And I'd call him peligroso, which is dangerous in the clubhouse. And we just, you know, all the Latinos were great and we really bonded well. But that young group, Steve Buchel, you know, I always said Steve Buchel would have been a multi-time all-star at second base, and that's really where he played in Stanford. But when we traded Buddy, you know, he was fine with playing third base, and he was a great third baseman. Unfortunately, he, you know, the third baseman and the first baseman back there were putting up pretty ungodly numbers. So good wasn't good enough, but he was unbelievable defensively and just a solid player. So, yeah, we had a good core of players that, you know, we meshed pretty well. And we were pretty, you know, successful there for a couple of years.
From 1985 through 1989, you played in more than 150 games each season. To what do you credit your durability?
You know, I just, like I've mentioned before, I would, in the winter, I would lift so I wouldn't get hurt, you know, and obviously to get stronger. But I just had a mindset that I just didn't want to come out. And I was able to handle the left-handers enough to stay in the lineup and not get platooned. And I, you know, I go back to all that BP with Albert, you know, lefty on lefty and just getting comfortable with that side, you know, side of the rubber. And just did enough to stay in the lineup against the lefties was going to be my biggest challenge because, you know, any 6'10" left-hander is not fun to face. And there was a couple of them at the time with Johnson and Candelaria, but for the most part held my own. And I'm not sure what my splits were career-wise, but, you know, I think they were probably fairly close. Yeah. So I would say, you know, just staying mentally knowing that you couldn't get hurt. You know, that was just my mantra to myself. Probably, you know, benefited me the most as far as, you know, making that all happen.
It was an era of great defensive first baseman, Mattingly, Keith Hernandez. Did you at any point correspond with them or talk to them about defense?
Yeah, you know, Matty and I came up through the minor leagues together. And, Eddie Murray, Ken Herbeck was great. You know, Wally Joyner. So we would always chat, you know, down on the, you know, at first base or whatever. And we always admired each other. Hey, man, great play. Will Clark. The first base was starting, you know, it used to be you hide people over there. And then the athletes started getting over there and doing some good work. But, yeah, it was a great era. I mean, for 10 years, there was some great first basemen. And, you know, challenge. I mean, you just had – they set the bar. You had to go get it. You had to hit like them. You had to feel like them. And but I appreciated all of them. It was, a fun group to go through the 10 years with.
Now, the Rangers did very well in 1986, but didn't replicate the same success in 87 and 88. What was the big difference in those two seasons?
Yeah, I think we probably had some injuries there that might have set us back on the, you know, on the pitching staff side. I think Eddie Correa went down. I think Guzzi might have went down for a bit. Bobby Witt was still cutting his teeth through great games. But I just, and I'm not sure going back who we lost position-wise and were there any injuries there. But, yeah, I mean, you know, you just, you do the best you can with the depth that you have, and maybe we just were falling a little short, both off the bench and maybe in the bullpen. It's hard for me to recollect. We had some pretty good bullpen. We had some great, I mean, Johnny Matlack and Tanana back in the day, you know, they were getting a little long in the tooth, but very effective. And then we started bringing in the younger kids. And then our bullpen, you know, I think got good at times. Mohorsik did real well. Odell Jones had a pretty good year or two there. But it just wasn't consistent enough. You know, if we were strong on the back end of the bullpen, we were kind of weak in the middle, or, you know, we lost some position players. Our lineup was just getting a little sketchy and stretched. So, yeah, it was disappointing not to be able to build on 86 for sure.
So in December of 1988, you're traded by the Texas Rangers along with Jerry Brown and Otobe McDowell to the Cleveland Indians for Julio Franco. Did you see that trade coming?
Kind of had an inkling. You know, you can kind of hear the rumblings. And I was going in, it was going to be, you know, my next year was going to be, after that was going to be my free agent year. So, you know, great trade. I mean, they got Julio and he stuck around, did some great things for them. And I went to Cleveland, just stayed that year. Otobe might have stayed another year or so, and Governor or Jerry Brown. So, and it was a great, that team in Cleveland was fantastic. I mean, Johnny Farrell and Buddy Black and Joe Carter and Corey Snyder. I mean, we had some good talent there. Good pitching, Dougie Jones. And so, yeah, you know, as a player, you kind of know you that's always in the works, possibly. So wasn't a terrible move for me. I mean, got off to a great start and just kind of leveled off, but had a great time with that team. And, you know, was not opposed to signing with them, but never really got a contract. Hank Peters was the GM at the time, and nothing really came about. So I just went into the free agent market and ended up in Seattle.
In Cleveland, one of the young players there was Greg Swindell, a highly touted prospect. Tell me what you saw in him during your brief time in Cleveland.
Yeah, Greg was a great guy. We had good arms with Farrell and him and Jesse Roscoe, Buddy Black. But Swindy was just a great, great teammate. Very, you know, good competitor, real good competitor. The one thing you had to do about with Swindy is you couldn't let him know how hard he was throwing. And we had a little radar in the dugout. And if he was under 95 and he knew it, he would go out and get shelled. So we had to take the little radar and he'd come in and say, you know, what am I throwing? And we're saying, hey, you're 96, 97, dude, you're dealing, you know, even though he wasn't. So that was always fun to watch him come in and ask everybody how hard he's throwing, because, you know, pitchers, you know, you can think you're throwing hard, but you're really not. So he was great. He was a great, great friend for that year, and good old Texas boy.
And Doc Edwards was the manager there. Tell us what he was like.
Yeah, Doc was, you know, Bobby Valentine was very, you know, hands-on, you know, a part of it, involved, and in all facets. Doc was just, you know, laid back. You guys are professionals, go play. If I don't like something, I'll tell you. So kind of totally different. Charlie Manuel was my hitting coach there, one of my absolute favorites. And Charlie was one of a kind and still is, I believe. Yeah. And he, it was a wonderful coaching staff that we had. And those two guys were terrific. Doc was great. Totally different from managers that I had before. Doug Rader was very hands-on and smart. And so it was different with Doc, but, you know, very enjoyable.
A lot of players really speak so highly of Charlie Manuel. What is it that he did that was different than what other coaches did? Why do people speak so glowingly of Charlie Manuel?
Well, he's just a wonderful guy and funny as can be. And he's got that West Virginia accent, you know. You know, he'd say, "Hey, Pete, don't be afraid to stretch somebody out tonight," you know. And he just kept it light and fun and, you know, again, not too technical. You know, I'd ask you, what are you looking for? You know, what's your plan? And, but a great communicator and got along with everybody. The pitchers loved him. The hitters loved him. And so he's just a good person, you know, that you love to be around, brought a lot of energy, and very fortunate to have that year with him.
For a brief period of time, you also played under John Hart, who is better known as being the architect of those 1990 Cleveland teams. So what was it like to have John Hart as a manager?
Yeah, John stepped in and was great. You know, and really a very good front office guy, did a lot of positive things, very committed to the Indians at that time. So, yeah, it was great to have him. He enjoyed being down there and it was fun to play for, you know, had brought good energy every day and, you know, not too over the top in any areas. So a lot like Doc, you know, kept it pretty simple, got to play good baseball and, you know, do what you do best. So, yeah, it was fun. It was fun having John there.
So in November of 1989, you're granted free agency. You mentioned the circumstance in Cleveland where Hank Peters wasn't particularly interested in signing you. Did you have a desire to return to Cleveland at that particular time?
I would have, you know, depending on, because I really loved the team you know, the ballpark was not a bad hitter's ballpark at all. The old mistake by the lake. So, you know, all that kind of coming into effect, you know, do you like the park you're hitting in, you know, da-dee-da-dee-da. So yes, to answer your questions, you know, talk to Tony La Russa, absolutely would have adored to play for Tony and what they do. They were having great teams and I was going to be playing maybe a little outfield, help McGuire at first, you know, just kind of roving. Tony loved that guy that could play a lot of different positions and plug and play them. But I just didn't like hitting in the ballpark. You know, I couldn't see myself 80 games playing in that ballpark. So that kind of, you know, I was a little bummed about that because I think that would have been a fun run for sure. Sparky called Detroit, love hitting in Detroit. Wasn't crazy about Detroit as, you know, as a city, but, you know, was just loved the team and loved Sparky. So those were kind of the suitors. And then Lefevre, who I also watched as a kid growing up with the Dodgers, but he was the manager and he really wanted me. He wanted to move Alvin Davis to DH, put me at first. And that just seemed like a cool fit. Plus they had Randy John, they had a great pitching staff, Brian Holman, Swifty, Bankhead, Eric Hansen. I mean, the arms were there to make a really nice run. And I just thought, hey, these guys are ready. They're close. And I'd like to be a part of that. And then just had an absolutely miserable first year there. Broke my thumb. Wasn't hitting up until then. Trying too hard. It was very disappointing first year there. And, you know, I just committed. I said, I'm going to have to win them back because I took a pretty good beating in Seattle by the fans and I deserved it. You know, I just wasn't performing and, you know, had a pretty good second year and, you know, okay.
Had you ever considered going to Toronto, especially when the Rangers were struggling in 85? 87, there were at least some rumblings that Toronto might have had interest in you. Was there any truth to that? And was Toronto on your radar?
Yeah, you know, I hadn't heard much about that, John. They had Freddie McGriff there for a bit. So I don't know where I would have fit in. And then who was Olrud was there. So maybe as an outfielder, they were maybe thinking, but I guess if I, you know, my favorite place to have probably would have played is Boston. I mean, that was my favorite ballpark. And I think, you know, they had interest, and I did hear that. I think it was the years I ended up getting a 4-year deal right after Ricky signed his 4-year deal, Henderson. And we didn't think 4-year deals were out there because the owners were talking, you know, we're not doing any more long-term, da-di-da-di-da. But anyway, I think the years might have scared Boston, but boy, Fenway was an absolute pleasure to play.
You mentioned about not wanting to be a designated hitter as a young player. Were you warming to the idea at all in Seattle?
Yeah, because Tino was coming up, and Edgar was kind of the DH. So, you know, I knew that, you know, after probably, I guess, going into my third year there, that's when Tino came up. We started sharing some time. I played a little outfield. That's when Griffey would come into see the lineup and see me in left field. And Junior would say, "Hey, Pete, just stand on the left field line. I've got everything else. Okay. I don't want you running into me." So yeah, I was kind of bouncing around, you know, and then writing was on the wall. Tino was ready. Edgar was coming back, you know, from an injury in 93. And that's when Lou released me in New York because everybody was back in. And so their team was set, and I think they ended up winning a bunch of games either that next year or the year after. That was the first year we finished over 500, I think, was my second year there. So that was nice to kind of get that behind you. But yeah, I would have liked to have been a little more productive in Seattle for sure. And I, you know, with those arms, and they didn't get all the arms back then healthy wise until probably after I had left. And then they brought in Charlton, who was great. That was one of Lou's guys from Cincinnati. So it's great. Lou was fabulous. All my managers were great. Lou's, you know, loved his veterans and just one of the greats.
You mentioned seeing Randy Johnson early in his career. What were your first impressions?
This guy's, you know, I'm busy. This is going to be a tough round of 4 at-bats here. And, you know, but he was just wild enough early in his career to where you could, you know, coax out some walks or know for pretty much you're going to get a fastball. And then after, I mean, this is what I've understood, you know, Nolan and him had a talk and really got Randy on, you know, on point. And once he started getting his slider over anytime he wanted and his fastball, he just became really, really difficult to hit. And yeah, his confidence just soared after that. He was hitting guys 3-0 count and they'd come down to first going, you know, what's he doing beating me on a 3-0 count? And I said, "Hey, I'll ask him." And he said, "Pete, I'm not going to waste the pitches getting back in the count. And maybe next time when they're 2-0, they'll swing 2-0 instead of taking that and don't get to 3-0. So he was really having fun pitching at that time. And the hitters were, you know, not having fun.
You also played in the outfield with Jay Buhner. What was Jay Buhner like?
Jay Bone. So him and Griffey were my locker mates in Seattle. I was in the middle of those two. Outstanding. Bone just, you know, evolved into a really nice power hitter. Great defensive player. You know, great arm and wonderful teammate. Jay was just a great guy. And, like I said, when he started hitting the ball, you know, he had power the other way. I think he went in the third deck in Seattle the opposite way, which is just, you know, unheard of. So the guy had tremendous power and really turned himself into a real solid, you know, player all around, which was great to see. He's just a wonderful guy.
In 1993, you played in only 72 games. What was your thought about where things were going?
Yeah, I knew it was kind of, you know, we had four kids at the house at the time, all under six. And, you know, part-time and was not kind of really work for me. And so when Lou released me, Donnie Baylor called from Colorado. He says, "You got any more left?" And I, you know, I'm thinking Colorado had a nice AAA year there. That, you know, that's not a bad hitter's place. But I just felt that it was just going to be kind of too part-time. And with four kids at the house, I think Mama Bear was ready to have me back. I was kind of there already. Maybe could have squeezed out a year or more. But, you know, at that point, I don't think it was just worth it to me. I was able to, you know, take my oldest daughter to first grade and enjoy their lives. So
after your career was over, what did you do?
So we, you know, we kind of piddled around a little bit. Then we got into the financial world. Both Donna and I got our Series 7 and we're dabbling in that because I was doing kind of my own investing and thought this might be a cool deal. We only stuck with that for about 2 or 3 years. And then in 2008, we opened up a spa in Colleyville. And that was a flotation spa called At Peace. And I was always interested in the sensory deprivation tanks. I always thought to myself, the body put in the right environment could probably do a lot of healing on its own. So we opened that up and kept it for, I think, 13 years and had a blast with it. Didn't make a ton of money. Nobody really knew what it was. But once they did, you know, we really started getting some traction in the and the regulars were really keeping us. We had massage as well with the flotation spas. So that was fun. Really managed that for a long time. And then we ended up manufacturing the spas. And that really kind of saved the day because the spa itself wasn't going to really be able to cover itself. So manufacturing the spas became a new revenue stream. And we just had a blast with that. I had a buddy, Dean Newneighbor, who was my MacGyver. We started it and sold that not too long ago. But yeah, I've just been piecing it together. My two brothers and I have some real estate up in Seattle that is, we've had since 85 and in King County. That's really just done super well. So I've been very fortunate.
You mentioned having the four kids at home. I imagine that that would make coaching unappealing, coaching or broadcasting unappealing. Is that fair?
Yeah, that is fair. And we ended up with five at home. Now we have four daughters and a son. But you're exactly right, John. I just couldn't see myself getting on the plane and you know, going around the country. It was just time for me. The family was very important to me. And I just felt like it was time to kind of give them my, you know, my full attention.
With the Texas Rangers recently winning the World Series, tell us about what it meant to you.
Yeah, what a special group, right? You know, and we had 10 and 11, 2010-11 special group. So it was a little obviously heartbreaking in 2010 and 11. Would have loved to seen Nolan and John and everybody, you know, finish that off, but it surely set the, you know, it was another stepping stone for this organization. And to see, you know, what this group did and Bochy, you know, I don't know what it is. These catchers are pretty good managers for sure. And he just, you know, he knows how to control that clubhouse for 162 plus and just a very humble group. As the manager is. And so just excited, really excited for, you know, Tawny Taylor, John Blake, Tommy Grieve, all these guys and gals that have worked in the front office and played and have been in the Ranger organization really since it came here. That just, you know, that makes me feel good for them. And obviously I feel great being a part of it and, you know, having some history with the club.
And you live in Texas now, and you played with the Rangers for seven seasons. What's your relationship like with the organization and the fans today?
You know, good. I don't go to the ballpark much. Might have some signing sessions every now and then. But, you know, my generation is kind of moved on. You know, I think Mike Young and Kinsler and those guys, it's kind of their time to be the newest alumni. And but yeah, we'd do the golf tournaments, you know, the Ranger Foundation. And so, you know, do five or so events, you know, and just kind of keep your, and, you know, Jimmy Sundberg, he basically started the Alumni Association, the Ranger Alumni, and has really turned, you know, that flourished under him and has continues to flourish. So there's a lot of activities that we'll get together and see each other. But as far as going to the game or being a part of anything, you know, front office wise or anything, no, just enjoying watching them.
In retrospect, what is your favorite on-field moment from your major league career?
Well, I think it'd have to be my call-up. My brother, Larry, since passed away, he was my agent. And perfect job for him. He was a commercial industrial realtor in L.A. And when I got to the big leagues and started signing, I asked Dad first. And he goes, you don't want me, you want Larry. So he became my agent. But Larry just consumed life, so much energy. He rallied the troops. And I remember we were playing in Anaheim and he goes, so dude, I got 60 tickets. And I go, wow, right there at first base. He goes, no, in right field. I said, that's miles away. Why are you in right field? He goes, because you're going to hit us one tonight. And I went, really? Okay, I like the way you're thinking. And so mom and dad had come down from Monterey, friends from Monterey had come down, all my friends from, you know, LA, Santa Monica area, his buddies. And I had two home runs that day. So, and one of them landed in my buddy's hand, basically. And he walked down 11 rows to hand it to my mom. It wasn't my first big league home run. My first one was against Gaylord Perry at home before we went out there. So I was having a nice, September, and to have that happen in front of all your family and friends was pretty great.
You mentioned that you like to watch baseball now. What are your impressions of the modern game relative to when you played?
Well, it's getting back to where we, you know, where it was when I was playing. I love the clock. I love the no shifting. Fregosi was one of the first that shifted against me in Chicago. He shifted against me all the time. I just must have had that 4-3, you know, aisle, second, first. But yeah, I just love the fact it's, you know, 2.5 hour games are perfect, you know, and the pitchers back in our day used to yell at the hitters, get in the box, let's go, you know, and then Hargrove upended the whole apple cart because he'd take a minute and a half to get in the box. So I do love it all. I think they just keep tweaking it. I think it's going to be big for baseball, but the time was the deal.
With the emphasis on home runs, you don't see as many players, aiming for doubles. You don't see players hitting to all fields the way that you did. Is that a lost art and something that also should come back?
Yeah, I think you're going to see that, John. I really do. I think, you know, ESPN got a hold of all the little kids and, you know, it was round tripper time, da-da-da. And so that became the thing. And then you have all the analytics coming in and spin, you know, exit velocity. And, you know, that's just a tenth of the game. You know, there's certain situations where exit velocity, you know, really is probably works against you, you know, just chipping one over to the left side to get a runner in or whatever, run in, or making sure you hit that little ground ball to second to get the runner over. It's funny, as you get into the playoffs, you see a lot of more teams going back to old baseball. You know, they're bunting. They hadn't bunted all year. I think the Diamondbacks were one of those, and they stole all the time. And so, you know, that was the game back then. And I think you'll see that coming back into vogue. I really do. I think the hitting coaches are probably the ones that had played the game or were probably hurt the most by all this other new information of what they had to adhere to or whatever. So I hope it goes back to, you know, the reason I like the no shift is you get to see the athleticism of all these great athletes in the middle infield and thirds and firsts. And, you know, getting back to Tony Gwynn, Rod Carew, and how they could just, you know, massage a ball just enough to beat you. And it doesn't have to be a, you know, a crispy line drive all the time, but it's, I think it's probably going to head back that way. I like the direction it's going for sure.
You had good power. You hit 23 home runs in a season twice, but at the same time today, someone, a first baseman might reasonably hit twice that. Right. Is that something where you, when you did hit home runs, were you trying to hit home runs or did it just come because you hit the ball hard?
Yeah, I don't think I, you know, and there may be hitters. I'm sure Canseco and those guys just thought about hitting home runs all the time. That would just get me out of my game. You know, I got long, you know, I wasn't short and quick. I always, you know, would pick out a, you know, something in left field, a hat, you know, I'm going to hit that ball to left field. And all I was just trying to do was stay back and let the ball travel to me. When I started thinking long ball or, you know, hit it hard, I just got long and it kind of defeated the purpose. So I just had to really think short and quick, stay the gaps. And if I hit it good, it's probably going to go out. And I was okay with that.
How has the position of first base changed since you played?
I don't think much. You know, I like Nate Lowe. Nate Lowe turned himself into a very good defensive first baseman in a year. And that's why he never came out of the lineup. So I think these guys are, you know, they're good athletes and they're good around the bag. They pick the ball. So I think, you know, for the most part, I think first base hasn't changed much. Maybe with the bigger bag, you can, I don't know, cheat a little bit more. I always got accused of cheating, coming off the bag a little quick. But, you know, that's just something, if you could steal something from an umpire, you know, just by a hair, because they're going on sound and foot, basically. So that was, you know, those were just some of the little things. But I think for the most part, there's some really good first basemen hitting for some pop. And, you know, you got to do that if you're a corner infielder. You got to do something. You got to drive in some runs any way you can.
How do you feel about the limitations on pickoff throws?
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm not sure how I feel on that, John. You know, is it so much an advantage for the runners? What did Acuña have, 70 and 40 this year?
Sounds about right.
Yeah, you know, so, and 70 isn't, I mean, Ricky stole over 100 when I was playing. But I'm not sure how that all fleshes out. I think, you know, the pitchers probably have to be a little more creative. And I think there's just an adaptation process that might need to go on because I think that might get exploited pretty good.
Now, what would you advise someone, a young player who's coming up, who wants to play first base? What kind of training should they get? What should they do in order to optimize their skills at an early age?
Yeah, I think, you know, I just played catch all the time, but for the most part, you know, when I got a little older and going into the gym, I jump roped all the time. You know, I always felt your hands are only as quick as your feet. So I wanted to have the quickest feet, quickest first step, and then go find Ron Washington because he's going to make you a great infielder.
And what does he do that is so distinctive?
Pardon me?
What does he do that is so distinctive?
You know, I think he's just got some drills and I haven't seen a lot of them, but anybody that's worked with him he demands perfection defensively. You know, he wants you to dominate defensively. And so does Bochy. They both kind of come from that. They understand the importance of defense. So, you know, as an infielder, if Ron Washington is your infield coach, you're doing a lot of drills 2 to 3 days a week, just book it. You know, I think he just keeps you right in that mode and, you know, backhand drills, pick drills, dive plays. I just think he's got such a knack for what it takes. And he was a great infielder, you know, so.
Sometimes when you talk to the really old-time players, they say weightlifting is almost a problem because you're building more muscle than your tendons are able to bear. And that they would argue that, let's say, just doing baseball things, throwing and hitting and so forth, are what you need to do in order to build muscle. But you mentioned doing some weightlifting early in your career, and it sounds as though it didn't cause you a problem.
No, it really helped me. You know, I was pretty lean, even in Nebraska, probably 185, 190 tops. And so I needed more mass. And you're not using all the manhole covers in the weight room. You're doing very selective baseball type stuff, but really your triceps, you know, your extension muscle and things like that. But it just, you know, you just felt better. You just felt stronger. You felt like, you know, your hands were stronger, your forearms were stronger. So I just loved it. And it was something I did after games. And, you know, I stayed on that routine. But still, it was a lot just because I didn't want to get hurt, you know, and I needed to stay strong and be able to take some bumps and bruises to stay in the lineup. And so that was, it was a dual purpose for me, get stronger and, you know, stay healthy.
What would you most like people to remember about your major league career?
I just enjoyed it. I mean, the game is, you know, it's surreal that you're able to play at that level. And I just, you know, I hope, you know, as a kid going to the ballpark, you want to see your favorite player. And so I'm proud of the fact that, you know, I played in a lot of games every year. And so hopefully I didn't disappoint too many kids that wanted to come see me and not being in the lineup. So I think longevity and just, you know, kind of being available for 12 years was kind of what I look back on and say, yeah, I accomplished that.
Pete O'Brien, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today for our Sabre Oral History.
Appreciate it, John. Thanks for having me on.